Welcome to the Educause Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. On this podcast, we feature audio from a webinar on mobile devices in teaching and learning. Our host is Veronica Diaz, Associate Director of the Educause Learning Initiative, and her guests, Kyle Bowen, Director of Informatics at Purdue University, Judy Brown, Education Technology Consultant and Emerging Technology Analyst for the Office of Learning and Information Technology at the University of Wisconsin System, Jennifer Sparrow, Director of Emerging Technologies and New Ventures at Virginia Tech University, and Lisa Young, Instructional Technology Faculty at Scottsdale Community College.
Today, we're fortunate enough to have with us four members of the higher education teaching and learning community who are also pioneers and leaders in mobile learning. And now on to our first speaker. Judy Brown is an education technology consultant who retired as the emerging technology analyst in the Office of Learning and Information Technology at the University of Wisconsin System Administration in 2006. In early 2000, she founded the academic ADL CoLab with the U.S. Department of Defense at the University of Wisconsin System and became involved in e-learning SCORM standards as the executive director of that CoLab. Judy has been involved in technology for learning for over 25 years and with mobile learning since 1996. Since retirement, she has worked entirely in the mobile learning area with corporations, schools, and the government. Judy served as a Massey Fellow for the Massey Consortium on Mobile Learning and as a frequent presenter at industry conferences and mobile learning workshops. Currently, Judy has returned to ADL as the Mobile Learning Lead. She serves on the Army Education Advisory Committee and coordinates the mlearnopedia.com and ccmlearnopedia.com sites. Judy, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to the Educause Mobile Sprint.
Thank you so much, Veronica, and thank you for inviting me here today. I'm very excited. I've been passionate about mobile learning, as you've heard, for a number of years now, but even more passionate to see it really moving into education. Let's take a look at what I want to cover here today. Some of this was covered yesterday, and I've changed a little bit of it. It's those of you that were on the presentation yesterday, but there is so much more about this we could discuss. I'll do just a little bit on the industry and why we should care, and then really concentrate on higher ed and what's happening here. We'll be hearing then about several examples from the three speakers following me. So I usually really get into a lot of examples, but because of time, I won't be addressing that today. But I'll be talking about a lot of opportunities and options for you and a number of resources, plus I'm sure you'll be adding resources, and I encourage you to in the chat on the side. And we will have time at the end for discussion. If we can start with a poll, Veronica, so we can get a better idea of just who is here, if you want to pull that up. Well, I can continue on what I was going to ask to see what your position was, whether you were faculty or faculty support or administration, content developers, et cetera. But let me go ahead and keep talking here, and maybe we'll return to it later. If you're writing some proposals, you always need to have thoughts. Oh, I see that you've got the poll up there now, so go ahead and respond to that. But I'll continue with the slide up here now. I do follow what's happening in the mobile industry and see how it will affect learning for sure. One of the people that I do follow a lot is Tommy Ahonen, and he compiles stats from, you know, the Gartners, the IDGs, the Foresters, et cetera, and has some really interesting stats. A couple of them that surprised me recently were that the average person looks at their mobile device every 6.5 minutes. Folks, that's 150 times a day, which is really scary. The other scary thing about this is that in looking at numbers out there, there actually are more mobile devices than there are toothbrushes. That's kind of scary when you think about it. So what is a mobile device, or what are we talking about here? And we'll get into what mobile learning is as well. To me, a mobile device is one that fits in your pocket or purse. And that brings the discussion, really, we could have a long discussion on whether a tablet fits or not. To me, it's something that you have with you all the time. It's available probably 80% of the day. It's connected. Most of the time, it doesn't have to be, but it does have connectivity. Has battery life that will generally last a day, and they're getting better. Has an input and output capability, and it's very personal. It's seldom shared. The question that we've got about this is, we know lots about mobile, and we know what we're doing. We're checking, you know, traffic, restaurants, and everything else with them, but what about learning? And we haven't seen that much about it until recently. Last year at Mobile World Congress, the former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, went out on a limb and said that Google, going forward, everything they do is mobile first. He was the first one to talk like that, and since then, many other organizations, including Adobe and eBay, a lot of different ones have said that they are going mobile first. And it is really a strategy that you should think about because it simplifies what you're delivering. If you think about, because the user is right at the front end of it, and you think, what does the user need and what do they want? So I would really encourage you to think about going mobile first. The bottom line, though, is that mobile absolutely needs to be an integral part of your technical infrastructure or environment. It needs to be part of your strategy because, as we'll see, more and more people are using it. If you can't ignore it, and I don't think there's an argument there at all. We're becoming a mobile society. One of the resources for you is from Ball State University, where they're looking at mobile lifestyle, and they've got some interesting things there. But they have been doing surveys on their students for the last, I believe it's 6 years now. This year, 99.8% of the students had cell phones, and over half of those were smartphones or touch-enabled devices. Yesterday in the chat, someone from the University of Washington posted theirs, and I looked at their stats, and they had over 100% penetration. So I would really encourage you, if you already have it, to really look and see what your students have and are using. I think it's going to help you make a lot of decisions going forward. The one stat that really shocked me recently, and I've given you this site here, is the number of users who are not using the desktop internet are using the internet access only on mobile. Now, I would have expected this in India and South Africa and, you know, in some of the countries up here, and you see they're well over 50% are just really only accessing the internet by mobile. But look at the U.S., 25% of users of the internet only access it by mobile. That was much higher than I had thought. You can get to the resources there on it. It was kind of surprising. Okay, I've talked about devices here, and I don't want to really devote much more time to what I call a shiny rectangle. It can be such a distractor to us. It's really not about the devices. It's about the capabilities, the affordances of these devices, what new things we can do with them. And it's about the experience. It's not about the technology, and I really encourage you to keep that forefront of your mind. A lot of capabilities are offered out there. We'll get into different things you can do you may not have thought of. Okay, we've been asked for a definition, and I'll tell you there are so many of them, and I've been in so many meetings where we're trying to come up with a mobile learning definition. It reminds me of the meetings we attended, many of you have, on what is a learning object. I think as long as you all agree on what it is, there are some good ones. What I would say is I don't think anymore that it's about the user being mobile. It's about it being ubiquitous, about ubiquitous access. Because most of them were written about the user being mobile, but there's a lot of capabilities to be considered within the classroom. I think Eli has a good one that's up there as well. Within the last couple weeks, I've been involved in a Mobi MOOC, and we've been discussing what is mobile learning. I really liked what John Traxler came up with. He's been one of the pioneers in mobile learning. But Dr. Kapp really on a tweet came back and said, you know, let's really say this together, that it's not shrunken e-learning course. It's not e-learning light with smaller fonts and tiny pictures. And I think that was a mistake that many people thought of, is that we were moving e-learning to these devices. It's not about that. From Twitter in the last week or so, there's been some really interesting discussions, several of which I love. Rudy DeWald indicated that Ray Kurzweil had mentioned that a child in Africa with a smartphone has access to more information than the U.S. president 20 years ago. Ray Kurzweil also made a quote that I've used and I love from handheld learning in the U.K. in 2009. I still think it's relevant. He said, mobile phones are misnamed. They should be called gateways to all human knowledge. If you think of that differently, it's pretty impressive. John C. LeGrand, whom I really admire, came up with a name for them as curiosity amplifiers. And I think that's, you know, we can now, if we're curious about something, we can get answers to things. Whereas, you know, I have intention to go back and look something up in a library in the past, and, you know, I never did it. I like Aaron Sober's quote here that it's not like it's its own thing. It's everything, but it's just not evenly distributed. And that's one of the issues that we have to really consider is equity in these and access to the devices. I developed this slide some time ago, and I would encourage you to take a look at it and see. And at the same time, if Veronica, you could put the poll down in the bottom. I see before we do that, okay, I see that there's not that many faculty. It's more administration and supportive faculty. But if you can see where you are on mobile, I'd appreciate it. But in this slide that you see up here, there's so many different uses, and I'm sure you've got other ones. I'd love hearing about it. Microlearning, I love. Looking at small pieces for decision support, simulations, field guides, location-specific feedback, reminders, all kinds of things, contextualized learning. Mobile learning has also been called bite-sized learning, handy learning, ubiquitous, pocketable, a nugget, learning nugget, micro-learning. And on the in the UK, they talk about learning pills. I'm not real thrilled with that one, but anyway. So it looks like most of you here are over half of you are investigating mobile learning, less than a third are planning, and about 13% have already implemented. Great. That's really interesting information. Thank you. Okay, let's continue here. I like this chart. It comes from a vendor, but it makes us think back about some of the capabilities and what kinds of things we can do. We, of course, can do voice, and there's a lot of tools out there that will allow, especially in language support, to be able to call in and record something. But in basic communication with texting to get to a mentor or a coach, we can deliver training. And I'll tell you, in corporate market, in compliance courses, there really are some successes. But that's not as much of a part of higher education. But access to materials, access to papers, documents, information, assignments, et cetera. Social networking for team. And I see Clark is saying that it compounds core capabilities with derivative applications. If we've got time, Clark, I'd love you. And I'd recommend Clark's book, by the way. He's got a new book out on mobile learning that's awesome. I think it's the first mobile learning book that I have recommended. And then, but why I like this slide is that it also brings into two-way, it brings into content creation. I really like that they be able to gather information out in the field and to use it. One of the people that I watch a lot, the organization is Ambient Insight, but the person there that does the research is a man by the name of Sam Adkins. And he actually said in December of 2008 that mobile learning had reached mainstream. And looking at this chart, you see we're just entering into the second generation with an unlimited reach with the devices. And we actually are able to do some of the second generation capabilities at this time. HTML5 is coming on strong. Some of you may be watching this Adobe Connect on a mobile device. You can certainly participate, but it's harder. You can't present yet. But a lot of things we're already moving into the second generation. Another chart, thank you for Clark's Clinovation as well, and the book is, Clark, you can put the book up there too. I'm trying to follow the chat. I'm not doing real well. I can concentrate on the slides and come back. One of the charts that he came up with recently that kind of shocked me is is a an indication of what the venture, where the venture capitalist investments are going, who's investing in what. And if you look last year, now this is only 1 year, so we'll have to see what happens to it this year, but everything is pretty well down with the exception of two. Exam products, which are really study aids, which are built for GRE, SAT, everything, which are really mobile device, content, and mobile learning is up. I think that's really interesting to see where the investments are going. We'll see if it holds up again this year. I have been working recently with the military, with DOT and some other government agencies. But one of the documents that had just come out of the Army, and this is for actually their graduate level even courses from TRADOC, is that they're saying that mobile learning, mobile computing, as they call it, is a game changer. But they're saying that they should not, anything that is going to change should not be taught in the schoolhouses, which they call converted to applications. That's huge. And it's really, if you're teaching a lot of things that are going to change before they're applied, it might make a lot of sense. You might look at it. Just this month, a new study was released, and I encourage you to look at it from Project Tomorrow. What's interesting about it is mainly for K-12, but the numbers were huge. They had about 300,000 students and about 42,000 parents, 38,000 teachers and librarians, and about 5,000 administrators. And the numbers that are there in your future students are really growing. And what the students wanted to do, they wanted to check grades and take notes in class. We're seeing a number of things appearing in K-12. In fact, K-12 is moving pretty quickly. They've had some interesting conferences lately. You may have seen this slide. I kind of like it just as another indication to really think about what your students need. This was really about a university website and what kinds of things we've got there and what kinds of things the students are looking for. It brings home to really, you know, talking with them and seeing what their needs are, but it brings home really the need to look at mobile as well. Another survey summary that recently is from fall of 2010 from Casey Green in the campus computing summary. I was surprised to see the numbers of mobile LMSs, mobile capable LMSs. We know that Blackboard and Desire to Learn and Moodle and several others have now, everybody's pretty well saying they've got a mobile solution, but at what level are they? But I found this very interesting, and it really, the ones that don't have LMSs obviously aren't going to have mobile LMSs either. But I thought that was something that I wanted to share. If you haven't looked at it, for sure take a look at it. One of the things that when I'm working with a group that is planning, and I see several of you are planning or investigating, one of the things I love to do is bring up these five moments of learning needs. And it really starts some very good discussions. My question to you is, in these five moments where we need learning, where is mobile applicable? And Veronica, if you want to bring that slide up, what do you think is the most appropriate? And I'll give you a minute to go through there. I think, well, but really when wanting to learn more, interesting, very interesting. I think you'll find that the first two have to do about teaching and the last three have to do with doing. And if you look at this and talk about where is it appropriate, mobile learning isn't the savior for everything and it isn't really for much. In some cases, it works really, really well, and I think this is a really good thing to think about when you're looking at deploying a project. You want to plan for success, and I would keep these five things in mind and have that to lead the discussion. When we first started this, no one said when learning for the first time, but I see that as you started thinking about it, many of you have come back, and we've got examples of people that are able to learn things in the field that they've never even seen before. So, I mean, they all can apply, but you know better off your subject matter, your topic. But I think that's interesting. Hope that's beneficial. Some of the benefits of mobile learning to the students on the left side and mostly with the devices are on the right side. I heard a lot of discussion yesterday. I saw some chat on special needs students. And I have not worked with it much recently because the audience that I've been working with for the last couple of years do not necessarily have special needs. They're military, and so they are able-bodied. But there is a site, and I will post it while the others, I'll look it up while the others are speaking, that I believe from the London Mobile Library that does has a lot of resources. Actually, the capabilities of these mobile devices that will allow you to speak into them automatically, they are really better originally as they come out of the box for special needs than they are for than the desktop. But you can go through these. The engagement, I think, is one thing. In fact, I'd like to relate, I've got a time here, I'd like to relate a quick story. When I first visited ACU, Abilene Christian University, a couple years ago, and I'm sure many of you that are following this have seen what they've been doing with deploying mobile devices to all their students, talked with a teacher, it was either a marketing or a art class, anyway, they were talking about fonts. And the assignment to the students was to go out and take pictures with their mobile devices and send them to this address where they would be posted to a website where they would discuss them the next week. Well, the assignments were completed right away. The students were all very excited. They came in for class the next week. Everybody had submitted something. They were all prepared. The problem that, and it was the best discussion that the faculty member had ever had, the problem was that, you know, 6, 7, 8 weeks after this assignment, when the assignment was over, students were still out seeing different signs, seeing different fonts, and wanting to discuss them in class. So, I mean, that talks about the engagement of the student. And I think that is all good, but you've got to consider also there's some other repercussions. It's something we wouldn't have thought about is how you stop something when they get that engaged. It's interesting. I love quotes. One of my favorites is from Seymour Papert at MIT, is that you can't teach everything, so you've got to, now that we have access to get to the information, how can we position them and how can we deliver that, something to think about. Some possibilities here, of course, in class, any of your resources, have you looked at EPUBs for any of your documents rather than PDFs? Very easy to do, just save them as an EPUB, and they're made available for any different mobile devices or for desktop browsers. For your assignments, for reach back, study aids, and any of your group learning with some of the social networking. Some of the challenges we talked about yesterday, and I'm sure they're going to be talking about them the rest of the week here with security and change both of the technology and change in the individuals are really hard. All these are pretty hard, but I think they're all worthwhile. Some opportunities we're going to hear about from the upcoming speakers. We've got two, Virginia Tech and Scottsdale. We're going to be talking about what they've been doing with mobile, with tablets and such. And then we're going to hear from Kyle on a lot of different, well, I guess we've got a different order here, but Purdue has been leading the way in a lot of different apps that really engage the students. One of the things I don't have time today to go into, but I'd really like to encourage you to take a look at it that has me most excited about the use of these devices is the spacing effect. If you're not aware of the research on the spacing effect to use time between delivery to improve retention, I would encourage you to do a Google Scholar search on spacing effect. Research is over 100 years old. It's called different things. One of the best examples out there now is what the government is doing, a site called Text for Baby, T-E-X-T for B-A-B-Y .org. And what you've got out there available to you is an SMS, actually to pregnant women. It started a year ago, and they've already had 135,000 use it, and they're looking for 1 million now. But it delivers materials when and where they're needed, like the first week back from the hospital, the first year of the child's birth. They're really, medical people are doing it. It really makes a big difference. With the collaborative, one of the interesting projects, in addition to the Purdue ones, is what's going on at the University of Wisconsin in Madison with the ARIS project. It's a location-based game that enables, in this case, it's back and revisit history and to learn about where you were. You have role playing and such. It's pretty interesting. This last week, I wasn't able to get to Madison, but they had their Eris Global Game Jam, and I had to send in these guides early. But their goal was to make 50 games, mobile games, in 50 hours. And actually, they ended up with 127 games in 3 days by 100 participants in 11 states and 4 countries. They had developer teams of 8th graders to grad students, museum designers, and even professional game makers. Pretty interesting. ArisGames.org if you want more information on that, and it is open source. Right now, just on the iPhone. Looking ahead, just a lot of things that are here just to keep on your radar screen. Some of the things that are already, you know, here, QR codes, many of you are looking at those. They've been around for many years, and I think will be replaced fairly soon with things like Google Goggles and such. But augmented reality, many of you may be looking at that. But some of the sensors, right now the most popular content for mobile learning I didn't mention before is language and culture and medical. And they have been leading. If you want to really see some interesting things where they've been going, take a look at those areas. Anything where there's behavioral change or reach back. I would encourage you to explore the capabilities and see where, whether the haptic feedback, whether if you're out in the field collecting, whether the compass, the cameras, the playback, any of these things could add to the learning. I just ran into an EDUCAUSE article quoted Howard Rheingold from 2002, where he said the mobile internet will not just be a way to do old things while moving. It will be a way to do things that couldn't be done before. And I totally agree with him. Think about other ways to get the materials across to the learner. Be capturing a bit of a lecture or what have you. Some caveats. I just pulled this from a recent planning presentation I did. Really think small. Think small bits. Think micro learning. Test it. You know, emulators are not good. We just went live with a big test that we're doing right now where we had comparing e-learning and mobile learning it's a compliance course. But we were ready to go online, and all of a sudden we found several problems. It was mainly with Android with different versions, and we didn't have all the devices to test. But you need to prepare for success, because the ones I've seen that have been just amazingly successful haven't been able to meet the needs of the users. If you've got devices giving you, you know, plan for sustainability, but really try to do something small and doable. Number of resources, I've got slides on the first two. JISC has an interesting mobile learning kit from the UK, as well as there's one from Australia that's very interesting. One of the sites that I work on is admobile.wikispaces.com, and I would encourage you to visit it. Although it is for the military, I think you'll find a lot of things in the articles, the books, the research, a lot of the development things, and we also have a link at the front to a weekly newsletter I do every Monday morning at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and you can access it. Is all the news on mobile learning and articles that would affect, whether it's better battery life or what have you, will affect what we're doing with mobile learning. Comes out every Monday morning, and you certainly can get to it from the wiki or the URL is there. I think I need it with half a minute to spare, Veronica. So I know you've been putting a lot of things I need to go through here and get some of these questions off. Is there
Judy,
specific ones you want me to start with?
Yeah, Judy, thank you. We'll go ahead and present those questions to you. Everyone, please stay in this room for our 10-minute Q&A period with our speaker. If you've got any questions, just go ahead and type them in the attendee chat there to the left. And thanks again. We'll be on to our next presentation in 10 minutes. But now, Judy, I've got my first question for you. Someone asked, who's driving this? Is IT driving? Is learning support driving? Faculty? Students? What are your thoughts on that?
Who's driving the use? I mean, the consumer is driving the use of these devices. I mean, we're finding all kinds of other things as they use it. The kids are with SMS. But in education, who is driving Many cases, it's an executive that says, why can't my training department do this? You know, I can do this. Why can't we do this? And why can't, you know, I can go to Best Buy or to whatever store and get these devices. Why can't I access some of my training? So it's really mixed. In some organizations, the training departments or the education departments have been told do it, and they're trying to figure out what the heck is it I'm going to do. And in other words, they've got ideas and want to do prototypes. It's really easy. There are some free tools out there where you can build something, you know, in a couple hours' time and bring it forward and say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this? And it's just not really fleshed out. I did that early on myself, and it makes a lot of difference. So, I mean, I don't think there is a real one answer to who's driving it. I think the students are in many cases, but you've got some real progressive faculty that have tried some things, too, in the academic world. Oh, and the other thing I want to say is, you know, folks, I know there's a global audience here today, at least from the schedule yesterday, from the map yesterday they were. The U.S. is behind. North America is behind. If you look at what's happening, it's phenomenal what's happening in Africa, what's happening in India, of course, Japan and Korea, and what they're using these devices for. We've got a lot to learn from the rest of the world, and I would really encourage you to take a look and see what's happening. We can learn an awful lot.
Someone also says that they've been able to argue for the use of web conferencing tools similar to the one we're using right now in Adobe Connect, since a lot of companies are using it. Do you think that students' future employers will be using more mobile tools, or will that help us to justify more experimentation and implementation?
Absolutely. We're seeing there's a new conference, or it was new last year, with the eLearning Guild has a conference coming up now in June called MLearnCon, and it's mostly corporate. And if you look at the, I don't have the numbers on here from the Guild, but I'm happy to give them to anybody, the adoption rate in corporations, and it's been driven both from the top and the bottom in using these devices, especially to their sales force and such, where they're the mobile employees that are out in the field, insurance investigators and such. Medical is the big one that's really getting pushed because they're using these, they're using iPads, they're using looking up with like Hippocrates and such. And it makes a lot of sense in the medical arena. As far as in other areas, it may not as much. It depends upon where your users are, whether or not they're mobile, and whether the companies have given deployed devices. But I just had an article across my desk this morning with all the government agencies that are really pushing everything to mobile.
And how much of the current thinking about mobile learning do you think is based on survey data, so maybe surveys that institutions are collecting locally, and how much do you think is based on observation of the use of these tools in students' environment? How do you think we're arriving at our conclusions and information about mobile learning today?
Well, there's definitely more research that are needed about the learning outcomes for this, we were challenged a lot when we went to e-learning about, you know, is it as good as the classroom, and a lot of that is coming out now, but it's not about the course. If you want to compare it as the course, it's an enhancement, it's an engagement piece, but going back to John Keeley Brown's comment, I really think that we do need more research on it. We're new. I said we're behind the rest of the world, and indeed we are. But I think that there's a lot that we can do and a lot we're going to be learning. These devices are going to be changing all the time. We need to bring students in and see how they're using them now, what they're doing with them, and how they could use them and how they'd like to use them.
And, Judy, we're getting lots of questions in the chat about the sources for the statistics you mentioned, and I believe some of those can probably be found on the two websites, or three actually,
right,
that are displaying now. So I would encourage folks to go take a look there. You might find some of those resources, or actually simply to Google some of what the comments were. The slides will be posted shortly after the webinar, so you'll be able to get those directly.
I'll look up the one. There's one really good stat site for mobile, and it's on admobile.wikispaces.com, but I'll pull it out and put it in the chat shortly.
We've got a comment, sort of, and a question from a participant who says that one of Plato's dialogues contained a story warning about the dangers of writing as a proxy for memory, the danger being that memory would become weak. And they say we've replaced writing in that paradigm with digital tools today. Will we be wise enough to use it as an augment, or will it devolve into a crutch? What do you think, Judy?
Boy, that's a little bit about, that's a hard one. But you know what? Things are changing. If you look at, I know that this quote was torn apart from Eric Schmidt. I used to use it, saying that in all the history of mankind, from the beginning of recorded history until 2003, everything, movies, videos, letters, books, everything, made up 5 terabytes, or exabytes, I'm sorry, exabytes of data. And his comment was, in the last 2 days, we've made 5 exabytes of data. And so how much of it is relevant, how much of it is current? In a world with changing, things that change so much, I don't think we've got memory to be able to store, to be able to know all that we need to. So we're going to have access to something, you know, because everything is changing so much. But, you know, there's other people in, certainly in education, than in theory of education and such, that would be a much better person to answer that question. Maybe we could keep it if any of the other speakers have a good answer to that, but that's a hard one.
Someone also observes that we find that all these academic mobile discussions usually do not seem to include the users, our students. They don't tend to participate in these kinds of online events or discussions or forums. Do you have any thoughts on how we can be creative in making sure that we include and tap into the student voice?
Absolutely. You have to do that. And I think by surveying them, by bringing them into everybody's probably got student senate or student group, and asking them, getting more people involved, having them. A lot of courses, the woman on yesterday was talking about some classes they had where they had challenges for 2 days. They had to develop some mobile content, and the students all really got engaged. That was a really good, I'd look at the session from yesterday for sure. Also would encourage those colleges and universities here that are partnering with business and industry, I mean, that they are having some of the same problems, and you may be able to access to work with them on some things and be able to fund some projects.
And someone also comments that e-textbooks seem to be very fragmented, or at least they're getting off to a fragmented start. What and who do you think will drive the convergence for a uniform platform in that area? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I really think that an EPUB is the coming one, unless the publishers have a big meeting coming up. And there was a good stat on the Casey Green Campus Computing Survey from IT about what's happening with these books and publications. But the money, really, the cost of return on investment for moving some of the text and some of these books to these devices really drives it, a lot of it. And it's happening. EPUBs, I really was surprised to see how easy they were and how nice they looked on all different devices without the user having to do anything. I also think we're going to see a lot of changes with HTML5, with a lot of capabilities that we don't really have today, making it easier for development. The authoring tools for mobile learning are still evolving, and they will continue to evolve, but they're getting a lot easier, and we're seeing a lot of better things. When I was doing presentations on this back in the early 2000s, it was where are the tools? And now it's, you know, what are the capabilities, what's possible? And I think a bigger thing that we're looking at now is whether you develop apps or whether you develop browser-based. And I don't see you being able to do apps for all the different devices that are out there in a reasonable, affordable way. So it seems to me that you should be looking at HTML5 for sure.
And I've got just one last question. For institutions that are looking to get started, this comment from this participant actually speaks to a little bit of all the options that are available to kind of dip your foot in the water and get started with mobile learning. But what's more important, do you think, to make course content portable or to devote your resources and time into creating applications that might support learning and engagement in the classroom?
I don't know that I'm going to, would say that they'd be applications, or they could be web-based applications, but you can do both, really, but I would go for the engagement and the learning, and I think that will drive the request for the others. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Great. Well, thank you, Judy, very much. We are now going to be moving into our 3 project rounds. Project rounds are fast presentation sessions where you'll hear from three community members on the subject of mobile learning. We have 60 minutes set aside for these next three presenters, but afterwards you'll have 12 more minutes to join them all for questions or for discussion. We hope that this format will provide you with the most information and also an opportunity for follow-up Q&A, which has been very rich so far. Our first project round is from Jennifer Sparrow. Jennifer is the Director of Emerging Technologies and New Ventures at Virginia Tech. In this role, she gets to play with new technologies and work with faculty members to explore the implications of various tools in teaching, learning, and research. She earned her bachelor's degree from Smith College, her master's in curriculum and instruction from Florida Gulf Coast University, and her doctorate from the University of Central Florida. She's a part-time blogger, an infrequent tweeter, mom of three, and struggling photographer with a biting sense of humor and not enough hours in her day. Jennifer, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica, and thank you, everyone. When Veronica was pitching the Mobile Sprint Week to us and she wanted ideas on what we were going to talk on, she asked that I speak about the overall mobility initiatives at Virginia Tech, and I laughed at her out loud. The way she asked, it sounded like she assumed that we had a nice plan of attack for addressing this game-changing technology. The truth is we didn't, and I don't think we still have one. But I'm sure, like many of you, we tried to embrace what we were doing, and we had multiple people looking at mobility from a variety of perspectives. Specifically, four questions. How do we create a mobile presence for Virginia Tech? How do we be like Stanford? Because they had it out there on the iPhone app, right? If you go ahead and you can answer that first poll question while we're out there, what platforms are you using on your campus? The second question we were really asking here on campus is, how will these devices impact teaching and learning? And we'll talk about that extensively because I think that's really where the focus of our conversations have been as we think about the approaches for distance or e-learning and mobile learning here at Virginia Tech. The third question we asked was, how can we provide access to these mobile devices if we're going to embrace them? So how do we ensure that our students have access to these, that our faculty have access to them, and that we can support that access through the infrastructures that we have in place? And finally, how do we prepare our students to be creators of materials for these devices? So the last question that was asked in Judy's session was truly interesting because it talks about what is the approach. Do we want to provide course materials on a mobile platform, or do we want to have students use these materials for or use these devices for active and engaged learning? And that really becomes the critical issue, and I think the answer to that, at least from our perspective here at Virginia Tech, is both. We had lots of cooks in the kitchen when we were going through this, and this allowed us for a broad approach to mobility with some pretty cool successes, but it led to what I finally refer to as the kitchen sink. All of those things we talked about above and more, and I love this picture because the area behind the sink is still being remodeled. It's the new sink and new fixtures are in, and they're driving the rest of the change in the kitchen. At Tech, this is true with our mobile devices. They are driving the remodel of some of our institutional policies and teaching and learning practices. But just like any remodeling project, we had our share of hurdles, roadblocks, and successes. And as you all know, whenever you take on a remodel project, you're never really done. As you can see in our sink, we have an iPad, an iPhone, and a Droid phone. Our approaches to mobility included a variety of platforms because we knew what our students were coming to campus with. Now that you've taken a moment to submit the poll, it looks like your folks agree that about 49% of you are using both. Which goes along with what we find when we talk to our students, when we collect data, when students come in, what devices they're using. When we take informal polls in classes, we're showing about 83% have some sort of smartphone technology. But again, we're still looking at over 17% that don't necessarily have access to that technology readily. We started with the iPhone OS because that's what our students were using initially. We had a sales push when students came to campus as a part of our laptop initiative. If they bought an Apple laptop, they got an iPod Touch. And so that's where our resources began to be focused. But you can see as we move forward, we're looking at the Android platform as well. And Veronica, I'm not able to get to the next. Oh, there we go. So the first, when we started our mobility exploration about 3.5 years ago, we got iPod Touches in the hands of faculty. What we really wanted to do was have an informal exploration of the technology. We didn't collect much data and we didn't look at the potential impacts. We really just wanted to have the use of the technology available for faculty if they wanted to explore it. And this really changed about 2 years ago when we saw how other institutions were leveraging iPhones and iPods. Our first formal foray was an attempt to get a VT version of the Stanford iPhone app up and running. We even had a really cool name for it, the Mobile Hokey. And this is where we started having to jump the hurdles. We ran into questions of how to license this application. This became mired in our legal department and Apple's legal department for over a year. I'm not kidding, a year. The hang-up was the risks associated and whether or not VT was willing to accept those risks and whether or not we should fight any battles we have in a Virginia court or a California court. Not only were these hurdles messy, but they were numerous as we negotiated to this acceptable level of risk. Veronica, I have another poll question I think we can put up there as well. Last July, yes, it took us a whole year, we were finally able to reach a legal agreement with Apple for the distribution of our app. The internal roadblock to distribution became just as equally as frustrating as the external hurdles that we had to come about. Everyone wanted a hand in the approval process. So thanks to Ken McCreary and our Integration and Portal Services Department, we had the Mobile Hokey app ready to go, but we had 7 or 8 departments that wanted to put their stamp of approval on it before we could actually get it out to students, faculty, staff, and other interested parties on there. So what we took a look at was IT security, university relations, what is the licensing agreement? Do we need to, is this free? Is there a charge? Where do those funds go? So we have a free app out there. It's called Mobile Hokey. We did have success with it. Yay. Ken reported that it's been downloaded over 4,000 times. It has similar information you would find on the web, so if you can get to the web, you can get to this information, but it's in one nice, easy-to-find location. Didn't necessarily go along with what we had seen with other folks doing on their campuses, and we'll get there on how we're going to move forward with that as well. So I love the fact that 50% of you are saying that you don't have a policy for who can develop apps that are branded by your university's name or with a logo. Again, those are hurdles. Part of me says just go ahead and do it and apologize later. If you don't think you're going to get in too much trouble, because truly working our way through 7 or 8 departments, I know was particularly frustrating for Ken and his group, who had this app ready to go, and it really sat on the shelf for about 3.5 months while everybody went through and put their stamp of approval on it. In the meantime, while all this is going on, we had a great faculty member, Dr. Osman Balchi, who saw the potential of what we had going on here, and he sort of skirted all these issues. We created a class called CS4984. It's mobile software engineering. It was focused primarily on the Apple OS. What he was looking for was to provide opportunities for his students to become creators of apps. So giving them the good 21st century skills to be digital citizens in a society where they have to not only use these devices but also potentially be programmers for these devices. What was terrific about this is that Dr. Balchi worked around the whole licensing issue that the university had. He required each student to procure their own developer's license for $99. That was in lieu of a textbook. Whatever they created was theirs. So if they chose to make something and market it and sell it for 99 cents on the App Store, that was their choice, and it didn't become an issue of intellectual property as of yet. And I say that with a caveat because I don't think anyone's made millions of dollars. Once that happens, I'm sure that our IP office will be interested in that. In addition to the course, Dr. Balchi created the Mobile Software Engineering Lab. He got a small grant from the IT department to set up basically a code kitchen where students can come in and code and work collaboratively in there. And he's had a lot of success with that in terms of the apps that students are developing and where they're going. So you can take a look at this. And I love the question at the beginning. Thanks, Veronica, for opening it up correctly. Is it learning if students can find out where the bus is on their mobile device? Well, if that device gets you to your learning space, whether that be the classroom, the library, the innovation space here at the Virginia Tech campus, then I'm going to say yes. So our group of students that have gone through, they've developed, for this particular class, Dr. Balchi's class, they did develop the bus tracker app. Super helpful on cold and windy days we have here in Blacksburg. Additionally, some resourceful students have created and licensed their own apps as they see a need. And that, to me, has been an interesting piece because we talk about where is the push for the development of mobile learning kinds of applications and whether it comes from the faculty or the device or from the user. And what we found in the past is that our students really become sort of the grassroots demanders of this types of these types of technologies. When we implemented Blackboard several years ago, it was the students who really pushed. They had it in one class and they liked the ability to see their grades and have access to their syllabus and have those resources. And so they would go to their other faculty and say, why aren't you using this? So it's very much of a grassroots push from the bottom up. And this has sort of been how we've seen the applications develop here at Tech. The students see a need, and either they develop them themselves or they find other ways to get the information out there and available. So if you're not familiar with our Math Emporium here at Virginia Tech, it is a 600-seat lab that's used for multiple purposes. It used to be just math, but lots of folks go in there to do collaborative groups. They can get math tutoring help. It's open 24/7. And as you can see, on Friday, April 15th, there were 220 seats available. I actually checked it shortly before we started this, and there were less than 50 seats available. you can check to see what the busiest times of the day are and also the slowest. In addition to these student-driven apps, we've also had extensive apps developed for our campus newspaper, athletics, and these are commercially developed and commissioned by a variety of campus departments. So again, everything in the kitchen sink as we talk about mobile app development here at Virginia Tech. One program on campus that's taken a very methodical approach to mobility is the EMBA program in Northern Virginia. The students in the program crack me up. They tell you how awesome it is that they get a gift of an iPad when they start the program. Now, it's not really a gift. It's included in the students' fees. All the students and all the faculty have an iPad. This was put in place starting in the fall of 2010. It's a cohort model, so the students move through the program together. As a part of their package, they get a $50 iTunes gift card to download the apps, and they're provided with a list of recommended apps, but there's no standard image that is provided for them on the iPad. Dr. Charles Jacobinus had some great feedback from students, particularly with the electronic delivery of course materials. They appreciate having the technology and the green aspects of not printing everything. He's looking further at e-reader applications that have the library of textbooks that are used in the EMBA courses, as well as how to get faculty effectively using these devices, and we'll actually come back to that piece. And that really leads to our next approach to mobile devices. On EdTech, we really wanted to think about how can these devices help increase active and engaged learning. So we're particularly interested in iPads up to this point, although we just got a shipment in of 15 of those Samsung Zoom tablets. So we are looking at Android right now, not on a large scale, but looking at it as an option to what we have going on here. And how do we remodel teaching and learning at Virginia Tech? We wanted not only to get the devices in the hands of faculty and staff, but also in the hands of our students, who, as we know from the early days of Blackboard, drove the adoption. We wanted to increase active and engaged learning, not just through the novelty of the device, but through a true transformation of pedagogy. The Learning Technologies Department here at Virginia Tech purchased a small set of iPads and had them available for checkout shortly after their release last year. We put a few standard apps on them, Pages, Numbers, Keynote, Dropbox, Evernote, Mobile Hokey, the Bus Tracker. But we really wanted students and faculty to explore how they would use them in their teaching and learning and come back to us. Initially, we allowed the iPads to be checked out for 1 to 2 week cycles throughout the summer. As they were returned, we asked what apps they had used, what else they would like to see, and how they could envision the iPads being used in teaching and learning and actually beyond. So take a moment if you can and answer the poll at the bottom, and we'll come back to that answer shortly. As the iPads were returned and we explored what apps were available, we started to include more apps as the standard image on the iPads. We had a pilot group of students who used the iPads for the entire fall semester, and their feedback was invaluable. Most of our faculty who tried the iPads either found them really useful and procured their own, or they hated them and they were glad for the opportunity to try before they buy came back to us with some feedback. It doesn't do X, it doesn't do Y, it doesn't do Z, or it does A, B, and C, but I can't see it being useful in what I'm teaching. So one of the active and engaged learning skills that we wanted to help our students to get thinking about and get our faculty to be thinking about was critical reading. Not just highlighting the entire page, but really reading for understanding. And there's a plethora of PDF readers out there and markup tools, and we like iAnnotate. We're not married to it. We'll certainly accept suggestions for what other folks are using as well. But our students found this very easy to use. Faculty liked it because they could mark up student documents They are increasingly utilizing this in combination with Dropbox, so letting students submit items to a Dropbox folder, being able to pull them in very easily, annotate and add notes. What faculty have commented on that they really like is the ability just to print the notes page, so you don't have to print the entire document, but you can go back and show the notes, and be able to collect and analyze those as a whole when we get through grading papers. The biggest lack for these kinds of PDF readers and annotators that we've seen up to this point is that there's no way to collect the annotations and notes of all the students in one location, i.e. a collective knowledge of about a particular reading that would allow all of the students in a group to comment on an article and then compare and contrast their notes. So anyone in the audience who's looking to make some money today, there's an app for you. Take what we can do in iAnnotate and allow us to collectively gather those notes in one location and create a collective knowledge on the readings that we're doing for a particular class. The second piece that we were looking at for active and engaged learning was working on with faculty on the use of concept maps. Again, lots of apps out there do concept mapping, and our students evaluated Jot and iThoughts HD, and they preferred the robustness of iThoughts. The Dropbox integration progressed forward. Students were particularly thankful for the ease of the transfer of documents. As part of our approach to active and engaged learning, we worked with faculty to envision how the concept maps can be utilized in teaching and learning. Some of those thoughts that we talked about and worked forward with were guided reading and note-taking, expert-novice concept map development, so providing the students with an expert model and then allowing them to develop theirs based on that expert model while not providing the answers to the particular subject matter, but allowing them to see how an expert would approach it, and then brainstorming and formalizing pre-writing activities. What's terrific about this, again, with the Dropbox integration, is that student samples can be shared through all students to all students through a shared Dropbox folder. And final submissions can be emailed directly to the faculty members so as not to violate any FERPA rules and regulations. Evernote, we utilize and put on all of our iPads because it's the app that I fondly call back in my day when we had to walk up to school both ways in the snow. If I had this app way back in the late 90s, yes, way back in the olden days, when working on my review of literature for my dissertation, I could have gotten rid of the piles of articles I had printed out and gone with organizing and tagging through this interface. Evernote allows for student and faculty collection, tagging, and organization of just about anything. It is cross-platform, i.e. it'll work on your Mac, your PC, your Android, and your iPhone OS. It's cloud-based, so it's available wherever you have internet access. Websites, articles, pictures, audio notes, and more can be saved from any device running Evernote, and the folders can be shared. So we're not only looking at the organization and tagging of knowledge, but we can embrace the collective knowledge of a class or of a group of students. Users can add artifacts to the Evernote file. Other students or faculty can view those items and add tags and comments. This truly allows us to be Google jockeys anywhere at any time. Student feedback on this particular application was particularly positive. We continue to work with faculty on their journey as they see the potential of both timely and collective knowledge of a class. The final app that we include on all of our iPad loans was recommended by students. SoundNote allows for simultaneous audio and note-taking recording. Students found this tool to be a great extension of their current note-taking habits with the added benefit of audio. As we wanted to remodel teaching and learning, we weren't particularly thrilled with an extension of the stand-and-deliver model of teaching. However, we found that faculty are using student-generated notes and audio as a platform for shared class notes. Again, an approach of collective knowledge of the course rather than just an individual student's knowledge. This approach, however, is not as widespread as we'd like, and while we try to move away from that stand-and-deliver model, this will be a continued challenge. So what does it mean for us? If you'll take a minute to answer the final poll question when it gets up there, thank you. We need to make sure that we are thinking about how we assess this and where we go on from there. So the feedback we've gotten so far is that students love these devices. See their smiling faces? When we go back to that picture, you'll see it there. The mobile devices are what they know how to use, it's how they communicate, and they're just plain cool. Some faculty are interested, and they've taken an active role in envisioning how mobile devices can be used in and outside of the classroom. Some faculty and students have reported that there are classes that have been fully banned any technology, as it is a distraction. Students have reported that these mobile devices have great potential, but until faculty accept and encourage the use of them, they won't have an opportunity to utilize them fully in their learning. Faculty and students need to continue to remodel their teaching and learning to include active and engaged strategies. As an institution, we must continue to support the development of our mobile presence. This includes mobile access to our course management system. We have to continue to provide access to these devices for those who don't have them, and we must think about teaching and learning and the potential of these devices as another tool for increasing student engagement. You'll hear next from Kyle at Purdue with some great examples of mobility development that should be a model for where we're heading. What is the future? It's the kitchen sink, the bathroom sink, and the utility sink, and all of those devices that we can throw in between, because it's what our students have, it's what they're used to, and it's where we need to be. Thanks, Veronica. Thanks, everybody.
And Jennifer, thank you. Our second project round is now from Kyle Bowen. Kyle is Director of Informatics at Purdue University, where he leads a development group focused on creating innovative applications within teaching, learning, and research. He recently led development of Hot Seat and Mixable, two new social networking-powered tools that enable students to collaborate via Twitter or Facebook, both inside and outside of the classroom. Author of the Exploring Dreamweaver series of books, Kyle has also contributed to or served as technical director for more than 20 books within the areas of web design, development, and usability. His work has been featured by the New York Times, USA Today, Time, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. His broad range of experience includes developing web strategies, applications, and instructional media within industry, government, and higher education. Kyle, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much, Veronica. Good afternoon, everyone. As Veronica mentioned, my name is Kyle Bowen. I'm Director of Informatics at Purdue University. I'm very excited to be talking with you this afternoon about some of our recent projects that attempt to capitalize on trends in mobility. Consider for a moment this particular painting. It comes up to us from 14th century Europe, and it depicts what the artist describes as a teacher and his pupils. Well, the artist probably said that in Italian, so I'm going to go with Wikipedia on this one. Now, if we look around the paper, the painting, there are a number of elements that we'll find interesting. You'll see that the students are sitting in rows, and they're paying various levels of attention. If you look real close, right down here in the corner, you'll notice that we got a guy sleeping down there. Let's take a closer look at a classroom that we have today. So here's a classroom that we'll see. This is one of our lecture halls at Purdue. It was taken last year, and you'll notice it's very similar to the 14th century. We still have students, and they're sitting in rows, and they're paying various levels of attention, and wait for it, if you look right back there, we still got somebody sleeping, right? So this is what we're dealing with right now. But there's something else in this picture that you didn't see in the 14th century. And if we look real close, we'll see it, and that's all the technology, right? Not to point any fingers, but here's a few of them. You see, the growing trend in many classrooms is that students are bringing with them their own learning technology, and in many cases, their own bandwidth to use it on. What's interesting about this is that we didn't have to tell them to bring it. They have self-selected their own technology. As an institution, we can capitalize on this trend, and we can develop new learning applications that take advantage of the technology and the tools that students are already using. And in doing so, we have a strange new ally that we've not really had before, popular culture. Popular culture has made it fashionable for the first time to have computing since the calculator watch. But this seemingly extreme adoption of mobile technology has given some pause. Some believe that mobility can be a distraction. Let me show you a quick example. If we look closely in this picture, in particular, there's a student sitting near the back. Let me highlight her right there. You know, she's wearing kind of a green and white striped sweater. Let's take a closer look at what she's doing from a slightly different angle. All right, so we can see here she's doing something on her iPhone. We can't be quite sure what, but in any case, this device is clearly a distraction to her. And we know this is true because if you watch here, she hasn't been able to finish her word find yet. This is a problem that plagues college classrooms across the country. Crossword puzzles, Sudoku puzzles, word finds go unfinished. And possibly the culprit is the mobile device. Sadly, this has led some to post signs in their lecture halls kind of like this one, right? This actually hangs in one of our lecture halls here at Purdue. Turn off your technology. Now, what has always struck me about just how out of touch this sign is that it references pagers. Really? Do we still have students carrying pagers? I don't think so. Pagers are like the fanny pack of mobile devices. If I saw a student carrying a pager into class, I would wonder what restaurant they were waiting for a table at. Right? This is the problem that we're seeing, is that we are out of touch even in our trying to set policy around these technology decisions. Nonetheless, the concerns about mobile technology being a distraction largely seem to stem from one core concept, something that's been called the cone of distraction. Right? The idea here is that a student sitting in the front of the room with their laptop open will distract a cone-shaped area of students behind them. We have all probably experienced this before or done it ourselves, right? Whether we're sitting in a classroom or possibly at a conference, you notice that your eyes begin drifting towards the laptop screen of the person in front of you. And in the case of students, what are they doing on their laptops? Well, they're probably using Facebook to tag themselves in last week's photos or something similar, right? Now, if you're interested, I've provided the equation here so you can calculate the actual cone of distraction. Now, keep in mind that R1 equals screen size and R2 equals the probability of PowerPoint, which I think you will agree expands the cone's overall size. So this is where mobile devices can begin to engage new forms of classroom interaction. They don't suffer from the same cone of distraction problem. They also make it possible to deliver the same type of in-class discussion outside of the classroom. Now, as we've developed new applications, we've started to look towards how we can develop these lenses through which we evaluate the technology. What are the unique capabilities of these devices, and how can that reinforce different types of learning? Now, we think of them as lenses because they're not mutually exclusive. We can use different aspects in combination to make functionality more interesting. Now, we're probably all most familiar with communication and connection aspects of our mobile devices. Communication largely deals with native functionality, such as voice and SMS. But this could also be expanded to include email or other forms of near real-time communication, like Twitter, for example. Now, the connection capability deals with accessing resources or online networks of information. We can develop new functionality simply based on a device's go-anywhere internet connectivity. Now, another aspect I'll be touching on with using devices is for content creation. The best example of this is with the phone's camera. Mobile photography has become a recent entrance into the mainstream thanks to popularity of apps such as Instagram and Color. Now, the final lens, and I'm not going to be talking about it a lot today, deals with location-based functionality. The obvious use here is related to GPS or global positioning, but this could really include a whole host of location-based services, such as check-ins, QR codes, or augmented reality, the types of things where having a device in a certain location actually benefits the experience. Now, for today's conversation, I'm going to talk about three of our experiments with mobile applications that are specifically designed to enhance communication, connection, and creation among students. So first, we're going to talk about mobile tools that enable communication. So the most mature of the mobile applications we've developed is something called Hotseat. The idea behind Hotseat is to create an open back channel conversation within the classroom. In a typical usage, a faculty member will provide a question or topic, and students respond in a real near-time manner using whatever technology they have with them. You see, what we didn't want to do is have or require any particular type of device. What we wanted was an unclicker, and this adopts the concept we call run what you brung. And for this reason, students can post to Hotseat in a number of different ways. They can access Hotseat from their laptop, they can do it from their smartphone, they can text message in off of a feature phone, and Hotseat can also be accessed as a Facebook application, or submissions can come in to Hotseat through a Twitter hashtag assigned to a particular topic. One unique aspect of Hotseat is that it enables students to ask questions and have them appear as anonymous to other students in the class, which actually leads to my first poll question we got a sneak peek of earlier down at the bottom. Should students be able to ask questions anonymously in class? It seems here, in early numbers, it's overwhelmingly, yes, they should be able to. And what we have found is that of the nearly 40,000 posts submitted by students within Hotseat, across the 20 or so courses to have used it, almost half have been submitted with this option. It's become a popular feature, especially in courses that involve openly discussing controversial topics. The best example I have of this is in a psychology course that discusses human sexuality. So trust me when I say those kids will do anything not to have to openly discuss sex. So this is the benefit that many students begin to see. So for some faculty, the use of social media in the classroom can be like an extreme sport. It is difficult to control, and it very much engages a counterculture. But we've still seen successes with it. As part of our research, we saw in our early pilot projects, we saw 86% adoption amongst the students in those courses. 86% we were thrilled with. 86% probably didn't buy the textbook for that class. So these were the kind of numbers that we were hoping to see. And with that, we also found some interesting findings related to social presence. In particular, this one. Hasi helped me see what other people in the class were thinking, right? So overwhelmingly agree, or strongly agree, that this is true. The other is seeking what other people in class were thinking helped improve the discussion. Again, we're seeing these correlations with social presence in the class. Now, the other aspect that we looked at was usage in correlation with their overall course performance. Now, there are a number of factors that could have impacted, their overall course performance, but the reality of it is that we wanted to make sure that, one, we weren't breaking the classroom, and two, was there some indication of what was going on? And that's what we found here. We did find a correlation between course performance and use of the system, and at the same time, we were also seeing, as you can see here, by and large, the students who got A's and B's in the class posted far more often than the kids who got the C's and D's, right? So with Hot Seat, we started to see how mobility in the classroom could kind of expand the existing lecture material outside of just the person talking in the front of the room. In one of our early pilots where the students were submitting questions for answering in the back channel, the faculty member who in the past would typically see 5 or 6 questions now sees on the order of 100 to 120 questions per class period. So this has created new challenges that I think you would agree are very positive, good problems to have because while increasing student engagement, they introduce this problem of how do we begin to sort through that information. So building on some of the things we saw with Hotsy, what we wanted to do is begin to explore the out-of-class connection. And that deals a lot with the mobile connection or apps that take advantage of a mobile connection. And to do that, what we did was we started talking to students about the tools that they use in the classroom. What are the tools that they're using while we're not looking? And, there are things like the learning management system, but chances are they probably wouldn't use that if we didn't have it for them. So what are the things that they used on their own? And by and large, the students, the common tool there was social media, in particular Facebook, right? Facebook was a big part of their lives. We learned that it was fundamental to life. There's earth, wind, and Facebook. And so that's where we set off to develop a kind of new collaborative environment centered on the classroom, but that made it possible to have those interactions outside of class. We developed a tool called Mixable. And what Mixable does is it begins to blend a student's course enrollment with their kind of social identity. And it begins to provide access to course resources in the places where the students are already living. So in this case, Mixable is presented as a Facebook application, which if you think about it, Facebook very much the student's native environment, but then at the same time it provides it to their mobile device. Now the other thing we did with Facebook that was fairly unique is that we didn't seek to replicate existing functionality. What we wanted to do was take advantage of the tools that already existed. The problem is that many collaborative tools try and cobble things together in an effort to bank on the convenience of having multiple tools in one place. But the problem is it doesn't necessarily do any of those very well. So what we wanted to do was take what was already being successful and implement it inside of the tool. And that's where Mixable, in addition to using Facebook as a delivery vehicle, it also integrates within the application itself such that it begins to blend your course enrollments with your Facebook friends. So it doesn't have any notion of friends or buddies or anything along those lines. It builds on the Facebook friends that you already have, and it can help you begin to build new connections. We also partnered with a company called Dropbox that provides online file storage as a way for students to share and have access from virtually anywhere to the files that they've shared as part of the course or the files that are being shared with them. The compelling aspect of this is that once the students finish their classes and walk away from the class or finish the class or graduate from the institution, they still have all of the files that they have shared and likewise any files that were shared with them that they elected to keep. Now, we also integrate with other popular tools such as Twitter, YouTube, and Vimeo, largely for video sharing. Now, we've also offered up a poll question, again, down at the bottom of the screen, dealing with this: providing course discussion within Facebook, is that creepy, common, creative, or cutting edge? A lot of different ways to look at this, and looks like, wow, a large percentage of people thinking it's creepy. Coinciding with that notion of the creepy treehouse, if you've heard of this one before, this is the idea where faculty putting students in awkward social situations. You know, we were very aware of this potential problem, and that's where what Mixable does is it abstracts that relationship between the faculty member and the student. So while the application exists within the Facebook environment, it does not require the faculty member and the student to be friends in order to use it. And actually, in addition, the student doesn't even have to connect it with their Facebook account if they don't want to, which is a big part of dealing with privacy inside of these kinds of open environments. Because what we want to do are provide open access to the student, but at the same time preserve their FERPA rights. And so that's why inside of Mixable, there are a number of checkpoints in place to ensure that the student is comfortable with whatever they're doing. And essentially, we inform the student and let them make their own decisions about the use of their own privacy information. Now, switching gears a little bit, the first one was really, Hatsu was focused on mobile communication with Mixable, intended to build out those connections. The last one we dealt with was really dealing with content creation, right, mobile creation. And the key piece of mobile creation, or mobile content creation, really is focused on your camera. In the creation of photographs and the creation of images. And what we wanted to do was capitalize on this functionality in order to deliver new kinds of experiences to our students, right? So we have we developed a tool called DoubleTake. And what DoubleTake does is it enables students or enables faculty to create assignments which are video-based. And then students can capture and submit their homework using a cell phone, using their laptop, whatever the means is that they have available to them. DoubleTake also makes it possible for the student to capture a video as a piece of self-learning content. So, for example, they see in one of our biology classes, they're experimenting with this notion of, you know, as a lab is being performed, the faculty member can capture that, you know, the portion of the lab and then bring it up on a display inside of the room, and they can talk about kind of what had just gone on inside of that lab. So think of it as sort of like TiVo for the classroom. So you can capture these elements and then reference them later. And this also becomes a part of kind of a broad peer evaluation structure, which is also used inside of the tool. So here's an example, and this is probably the best example I could give you about kind of how video can be used to enable a new form of assessment, is that we used DoubleTake for an American Sign Language class. So there are a number of students in our ASL program, and if you think about it, there's just really no possible way to do a written assignment in American Sign Language. So the students, and so in this one example, here's three different assignments from the same student, so you can kind of begin to see the progression of work, that they capture those assignments and then turn them in. And then using an interactive rubric editor, the faculty can create rubrics for assessment, and they can also use that as part of a peer evaluation experience. So these are aspects, new things that we're kind of working on. The trick here, though, is that not everybody is comfortable working on camera. So it's something to kind of think and keep in mind as you start to look towards video as an assessment mechanism. And that's where, you know, we've all probably heard of studies that suggest that people fear public speaking more than they fear death. And I think it was Seinfeld who pointed out to us that at a funeral, more people would rather be the person in the casket than the one giving the eulogy. Right? So we have to be kind of aware of these concerns as we begin to make these assignments in our classes. And I'm completely running out of time here, so I'm going to bounce over. But one of the key aspects of DoubleTake is it integrates in our existing infrastructure so that in order to encode the video, it encodes it on machines that aren't being used on locations across the university network. And I can talk about that more if you have particular information about that. And the other aspect we've focused on with our mobile tools is really dealing with assessment. So how do we collect the data and provide it to our faculty in such a way that they can use it to fuel their own instructional improvement? They can begin to look at how students are interacting with their courses. So a big part of this is that as you look across, you know, the social tools, we're looking at a disaggregation of this content. So as students are using open tools like Facebook or Twitter, how do we know what's going on there? We're giving up all of these learning analytics to these companies. So what we have to do are creative solutions that, that bring that information back. So the same way that our grocery stores use these kinds of key cards to track our purchases to sell us better things later, we can use the same kind of information to help drive new forms of tools. And the last point I wanted to make was really the key piece here is as we build these mountains of data, what we have to do is begin to extract knowledge from this information. It's a lot like if you've heard of this concept of counting cards in blackjack, whereas you count the questions count the cards being played early, so that you can determine of the overall success of the hand later on. And that's kind of what we need to begin to look at as we collect this information: is how can we use how students interact with these tools in order to help support decisions made later in the class, identify potentially students at risk, or identify or be proactive in providing help resources to students in particular areas. So thank you very much for your time today. If you have any more questions or thoughts about or want any more information about some of our projects, you can check them out at purdue.edu/studio. And with that, I'm going to turn back over to Veronica so she can introduce Lisa.
Kyle, thank you so much. Our last project round today is from Lisa Young. Lisa is an instructional designer and educational technologist. She's worked at the Maricopa Community Colleges for 17 years, 4 years as adjunct faculty, and 13 years as residential faculty. After spending 16 years as occupational faculty and program director of three programs at Gateway Community College, she has recently transitioned to instructional design and educational technology faculty at Scottsdale Community College. She has a Master of Education in Learning and Instructional Technology from Arizona State University and a PhD in Instructional Design for Online Learning from Capella University. She works with faculty members to assist them in the development and delivery of their hybrid, online, and traditional classroom-based courses. And she shares information on instructional design strategies, engagement, delivery, and facilitation techniques, and instructional technologies. Lisa, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica. Hi, everybody. I'm thrilled to be here. For those of you out west, good morning. For those of you out east, good afternoon. I'd like to share with you today some information on a pilot program that we've been trying out here at Scottsdale Community College and using mobile technologies. When we first heard the announcement about the iPads, you know, we watched Steve Jobs streaming, and we were so excited about the potential that iPads could have on teaching and learning. And so we decided, well, we need to try this. So we put together a pilot program, and we wanted to look at a number of key areas. The first thing that we were concerned about was how faculty could potentially use this new technology for teaching. We also wanted to see how faculty and staff could use iPads for productivity, how faculty and staff could support teaching and learning and student use in regard to the use of the iPads, and how we could hold people accountable in sharing what they're learning and what they did throughout the pilot program. So the first thing that we did was we ordered equipment. We ordered slightly over 50 iPads. And we provided, for each iPad, we made sure that we had a keyboard, a stylus, we made sure that we had a camera adapter kit, and VGA cables so that they could be used throughout the college. So what we ended up doing was we had 5 iPads that could be checked out for short-term 2-week periods by faculty and staff. The idea was that there would initially be preloaded apps, or that faculty and staff could sync them to their own iTunes account. We also got 7 iPads that were checked out for long-term use by individuals in key areas, whether it was our technology trainers, our help desk, some key faculty who are those early adopters who try things all the time as well. And then we also got 5 iPads that we put in student support areas. One of the things that I was most excited about was being able to provide an iPad to our reference desk in the library, because at our library we have stations where students work on their computers, and what happens is they have a question for the reference desk, and so they end up having to pack everything up, log off the computer, go to the reference desk, ask their question, and then often find another computer to be able to get back to their work. With the technology that we have in the iPads, we were able to have the reference librarian walk around and go to the students. We also put these in all of our tutoring centers and our writing center so that, first of all, if students came in with questions, we could answer them. And secondly, we could explore different apps that we could use to help our students learn. And finally, we put these iPads in the hands of our students. We purchased enough apps for two classes of our students. We had two faculty apply for a grant where they were able to use these iPads with their students for a semester in one case and an entire academic year in the other. So we do have a poll asking you, do you check out your iPads for student use in and out of the classroom? And it looks like the majority of you don't. Some of you, just a few, one in fact, check them out for in-classroom use, and some of you do check them out for in and out of the classroom use. Well, our idea was that we were going to provide these iPads to students to use in and out of the classroom. So they were checked out for in one case, a semester, and in the other case, the entire academic year for them to use. So we provided, we purchased for the classroom 30 iPads for students, two for the two instructors, and then we had two in case of breakage and loss. And then we also provided the students with keyboards, and we provided them wireless keyboards. So we wanted to do a number of things through this pilot study in terms of looking at teaching and learning. And so we wanted to find out how students were using the iPad. We wanted to find out how they could access their ebook. We made a partnership with our publisher to get the ebook for free for these students. And so we wanted to know, do they like it? Do they like accessing the online resources for the class and the ebook through the iPad? We wanted to also test our virtual environment. We have a Citrix environment here at SCC, and we have over 200 applications in the cloud, basically, in our MySCC virtual environment through Citrix. So we knew that we would be able to expand the functionality of the iPad to include Microsoft products, at the time Adobe products, a number of different software applications that the iPad wouldn't normally be able to access. And so we wanted to test that virtual environment. And we wanted to also find out how faculty could use it and how the learning curve was and what support we would need to provide to faculty to really have them embrace using this in the classroom. So the two classes that we looked at were a news writing class and an entire year of honors freshman composition. So with that, we did have a number of partners that helped us put these iPads in the hands of our students. McGraw-Hill provided the ebooks and course sites free of charge. We had the partnership with Citrix, and our IT department here at SCC was a huge help and assistance in helping us troubleshoot all sorts of any issues that might have arisen, and really working closely with the faculty, with me as an instructional technologist, the students through the help desk, so on and so forth. So we had a number of applications that were used by faculty, students, and staff. And in regards to the applications, we were really concerned about accountability. If we were going to be buying applications or having people use them, we wanted to be able to find out how it was going with the apps, what they liked, what they didn't, what areas might be problematic. Because if we are buying apps for a classroom of students and it doesn't work out, we don't want to buy them for another classroom of students. So we actually created a Google form in which, when we bought an app, we asked students, faculty, and staff to please review it, and also if they bought apps on their own, to provide a review. And so now we have a database of those reviews. So if someone asks for an app, we go and we take a look at it first to see if it was deemed as being something that was, you know, positive, or if it really didn't work out the way they wanted, so they could have a discussion before we purchased them for another group. And these are just a couple of the apps that we used on our website, which we'll provide later, I have the full listing of the apps that we used as of April. So we looked at a number of instructional activities, and the faculty really were so excited to do this. And initially, they started out with some of the activities that they generally did in class if they had taken the students to a computer lab, and then they realized that they had so much more power in their hands. But initially, they were using it for Blackboard, for the students to take quizzes. They also used it in the journalism class to record interviews. And what was really cool was they were able to conduct the research, the students write interviews, take notes, and write their news stories all from the iPad. So they were able to use 5.0 Radio, which is an app, to find out what was going in the world and respond, and the community, and respond immediately to things that were being broadcast on this radio, this police radio, through the iPad. Then when they got on scene, they were able to use Sound Recorder Pro to record interviews with whomever they were interviewing. They could then either type, they could type up notes at the same time as they were recording. They could also write their stories and research using a number of different apps like the ABC Player, BBC, New York Times, USA Today, what have you, and pull all of that information. So the students were able to do all of that right from their iPad, sometimes out in the field, sometimes in the classroom, and they were able to write up their stories using Microsoft Word through our Citrix environment and submit those for their assignments. So I have another poll for you that I'd like to ask you in regard to how your students are using iPads. And it looks like a lot of data is still coming in. But the majority of us think that our students are using it mostly for media consumption and then for learning. And I think that's pretty close to accurate in regard to how students are using it, and that's how we're seeing it as well, and definitely seeing it that way too. In regard to the English class, what was really fascinating was I had regular meetings with the faculty who were using the iPads, and what was most interesting was that one of the faculty said to me, wow, I really had to change the way I taught. I thought I would just bring in this technology and teach the way I normally do. But there was a big realization between the first semester and the second semester of I have a new tool that I can use to meet my learning outcomes, engage my students, and really expand what I can do in the classroom and help my students learn better. And so initially for the English classes, it was the iPads were being used to access Blackboard to conduct some research. But it expanded to developing multimedia presentations and beyond just writing papers. And he found that it was really a great experience to have the students, the same students in a cohort for the entire academic year, because at the beginning there was a little more time needed for introducing the technology and getting everyone acclimated, and he was able to shift some of that learning so that, of course, he could cover all of his course competencies and really engage the students with the technology and really help their learning. So in looking at this, the good of our iPad pilot was increased engagement. Students were engaged in using the iPads, and I'm going to show you some data in just a moment. They definitely wanted their iPads in other classes, and you know, we saw the sign earlier today that Kyle showed of, you know, no technology in the classroom, and they were often disappointed that they couldn't use their iPads in other classes. And the students took to the new technology very easily. Some of the cons were we had some bandwidth issues. We couldn't handle all of the iPads at the beginning being used at the same time in some of our classroom buildings. And so we addressed those. Initially, we had some problems with purchasing apps, and we resolved that. The issue of projecting, which is now no longer an issue with the iPad 2, but a lot of times the faculty wanted to be able to have a projector mirror what they were doing so they could show more of what was going on, and only certain apps were able to be projected onto a screen. And that is going to be resolved with the iPad 2, and so we're getting the instructors iPad 2 so they can better do that. Of course, you know, there's always the issue of distraction of games and applications. And then also some student anxiety with the use of this new technology and, you know, will this work and when did, will they have Wi-Fi? But they really quickly ferreted out where they could find Wi-Fi and if they don't have it at home, they knew they had it on campus and it worked out pretty well. So in regard to data that we collected data pre-semester, mid-semester, and post-semester. And during the mid-semester, we asked the students how they were using it away from school. And, of course, they were surfing the web and social media, just like you mentioned, you know, media consumption as well as reading the textbook and the websites and doing their writing. In class, they were using it mostly for accessing Blackboard, reading textbooks and websites. MySCC is our Citrix environment. And so you can see that they were using it a number of different ways, both in the classroom and at home, but not the same ways in the classroom and at home. Additionally, in terms of how they were able to look at their iPad use, they used it most at school, not as much at home, but they really wanted, as I mentioned earlier, to be able to use it in their other classes. And they were really happy with the use of it in terms of an educational tool, the majority of the students. At the end of the semester, we did some surveys, and I know this is a lot of information on this slide, but basically they thought that they would use the iPad more than like a laptop. They liked the lower weight, the portability. As Judy mentioned earlier, you know, mobile technology fits in your purse. A laptop, well, some now laptops do, but last year a lot of them didn't. Also, they were really disappointed that they couldn't print from their iPads. That's something that we continue to work on here at our campus. And they were using it for schoolwork off campus. While they were mostly consuming media, they were using it for their schoolwork, especially as the semester ended. And the majority of them recommended the use for other classes. So we had a number of lessons learned in terms of our iPad pilot project. And first of all, the initial setup can be a lengthy process. If you give a faculty member 30 iPads, it's going to take a while to set up. We really looked at how we should have people using them. Should they be using their own iTunes account? Should we be providing an image on the iPads? And for the students who had it for a long-term checkout, we basically, you know, let them sync it to their own iTunes accounts. And when we purchased apps, those were consumables that, like, that could be used with a course fee. And so that's how we viewed those apps. The short-term versus long-term loan, when the students had it for a longer time, they were much more comfortable using it. There's training for faculty, training for students, and as I mentioned earlier, that need to change instruction, you know, to modify how the teaching is, how and the engagement with the students. I do have a poll, which many of you are responding to, regarding what potential challenges do you see for implementing a similar type of project at your campus. And it looks like funding is definitely a big issue. And what we found was that by installing our Citrix environment, our software licensing costs decreased, and we were able to fund some of these projects and other innovative projects for our school with the cost savings. Also, faculty interest. If the faculty aren't interested, then, you know, it's really not something that should be tried in the classroom, because it will not be as successful as it could. And like Jennifer mentioned, you know, some faculty loved it. Some said, oh, this was, you know, a great experiment. I'm glad I got to try it. It's not for me. In terms of the next steps, our iPad project is really becoming a mobile project, and we did purchase a classroom worth of iPads for library instruction. Now we can take library instruction to any classroom on campus, which is really great in terms of providing those services to all of the classes that would like them across the campus. We're also going to be increasing or adding another component to our pilot in regard to Google Chrome laptops. As soon as they come out, we'll be purchasing those and having all of our student success courses using them on campus, and also trying those out in an English class. We think that might be a little more successful in regard to the typing of papers and such, so we're going to try that. We have ordered some iPad 2s to replace the instructor iPads, as well as We've got a Zoom in to play around with and see if we think that might be an option for instruction. And we're putting together some best practices for classroom use and really trying to help individuals select the best device for their instructional needs. And with that, this is our website for our all the information we have on our pilot project. Really funny thing is that it's developed in Flash, so it won't run on your iPad, so you do have to use a computer or an Android device to access that. And if you'd like more information, please feel free to contact our iPad pilot project team. And thanks so much for your time.
Lisa, thank you. Several folks commented that they really enjoyed listening to a community college example of mobile learning innovation, so thank you so much. Everyone, please stay in this room for our 12-minute question and answer period that will begin now with our speakers. So if you have questions, just go ahead and type them in the attendee chat to the left. We'll be watching the chat and posing your questions to our speakers. And with that, I'll go ahead and get started with one of our first questions that came in a while ago. And this could be for any of our speakers. What specifically do you think that mobiles uniquely do that other technologies cannot? If there is little, then perhaps there's little value. So maybe some of you can draw from some of your local examples of what you found that is really unique to the mobile technology.
This is Jennifer. from our perspective, it's an instant on anytime, any place access to knowledge and how do we get there. So for us, it's on demand.
This is Lisa. For us, it was a lot of the apps that really transformed the classroom experience in regard to having access to police scanners and having access to the news sources anywhere the students were. So it really was the mobility.
We got some questions for Virginia Tech. Someone commented that Virginia Tech's mobile presence seems more administrative than academic so far. And is it cross-platform, as cross-platform as it appeared? Jennifer, you want to comment on that?
Sure. We certainly, from my perspective, I'm in learning technologies. We are certainly looking at the focusing on the academic side. But I wanted to present the overall overarching mobility piece, so pulling in the additional pieces, the challenges that we've had in terms of addressing mobility were key to the presentation. But our focus, particularly in learning technologies and, again, with the folks that are teaching the classes for the mobile development, it is academic. And, no, it's not as cross-platform as it seems. We have been highly focused on the Apple iOS, but we are looking at Android. Again, we're getting more of those devices in, and we realize that if we're truly going to be players, and our motto here is invent the future, if we're going to be truly inventing the future, we need to be able to look at all the platforms that our students come to campus with. And if that means a Windows tablet or a BlackBerry tablet, then we need to be able to provide those materials in such a way that meets the needs of our learners.
And this question might be good for Lisa and Jennifer. For faculty mobile devices, how did you all handle purchasing the apps, both maybe apps that faculty wanted after the fact and then before? How did that work, and did you run into any obstacles there?
That's such a timely topic. I've got 3 emails sitting in my inbox since we've been on this conversation from my boss, who we had a situation in place where we could, if faculty requested it, we had a budget, we would order the apps and put them on as needed and as requested. And we looked at that as very much of a way to test new apps, get them in the hands of faculty, get them using these devices. That has since been evaluated by the person who pays the bills, and we are told we cannot do that. So, again, we are in negotiations with Apple for a bulk licensing option, which apparently, again, we still go back to the idea is if there's a problem, do we handle those problems in a Virginia court or in a California court? So we're at an impasse right now. If faculty want to put applications on, they have to do them through with their own monies at this point. If we want to do them internally, we have to purchase them on our own monies and then ask to be reimbursed for them.
And for us at SEC, we have a volume agreement with Apple, and with the serial number of the iPad and the email of the iPad of the iTunes account, we're able to provide that app to the device. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we use it more as we consider it more as a consumable. We had a lot of difficulty at first figuring out how we were going to do this, and at the beginning of our pilot with the students, we used all free apps specifically because of that. But now with it took a while for Apple to kind of catch up with education, I think. But with the App Store Volume Purchase Program, we've really been able to make some strides in that. I think that as more classrooms use that and we're providing them to the students, it will probably come out of course fees in the future.
And this next question is for Kyle. Someone observed that it sounded like what you were saying was that mobility and mobility tools really are helping to transform education from teacher-centered to student-centered. But Kyle, do you think learning should be centered around the teacher, the student, content, process, or something else, or all of the above?
That's a fantastic question. So many of our tools to this point have really been focused on enabling the student. So really, in terms of the learning technology provided on campuses are typically aimed at the faculty with the intent that if we make the faculty better teachers, then their students will be more successful, which is a largely a true statement. But then we can also look at the problem from the other side and say, look, if we made students better learners, could we also not make them more successful that way? So that's where with our tools we've designed them such that they're really kind of focused on the student, letting the student have more control. Mixable is probably the best example of that because inside of Mixable, the faculty member has no more access or control of that conversation than the student does. And the other part of it is that students can decide to use Mixable inside of their class, so it's not a determination necessarily made by the faculty member. So that's where, you know, we can begin to provide technology that enable that student the same way we can provide technology to enable the faculty.
And then another couple of quick logistical questions for you, Kyle. Are your Purdue apps available in the App Store, and do your students have free Dropbox accounts, or does Purdue pay for storage?
Sure. DoubleTake has an app in the App Store, but most of our apps are designed around mobile web. They're right now exclusive to Purdue students. If you have interest in obtaining the tools, please contact me offline. I can talk more about that. And then the last question about Dropbox accounts, that's where the students come to Mixable with their own accounts. So really they broker that with Dropbox. We don't necessarily get in the middle of that.
And this question for all three presenters, really, what kind of backups, cloud, network, do you provide for your mobile devices in case something breaks or goes missing? What do you do in that area?
This is Lisa. For us, we had, for the classroom experiment, we had extra devices in case we had a problem. And with that, we actually did have one student who had a theft of an iPad, and they signed agreements before that they would cover the cost, and so that student will be reimbursing the college, but we did at least have a backup so that student wouldn't, you know, not be able to continue with his instruction and his learning activities. So we did have backup devices, and then with iTunes, they have their own backup of their apps.
That's the same here at Virginia Tech. We have the a loaner pool that we have for backups, and we'll continue to do that as we move forward. And when you hook the iPad up, it does say, do you want to revert to a former image of this? And that's actually what we do when all of our iPads come back in, because we want a clean restore. So that hasn't been a problem up to this point.
And someone makes the observation that it seems like the problem still remains of how to institutionalize pilot programs, such as the one that Lisa mentioned today. Do you have any ideas, or do we need to institutionalize these types of programs, or is it that as technology develops so rapidly and users have preferences for devices and those change, maybe we don't need to institutionalize? Any thoughts on this point?
Well, it's Kyle. I think the goal here is as part of we have to implement pilots that have the potential to scale, and so that's kind of a key aspect of this. So you know, how can we design things such that they're simple enough that they can work across multiple devices? Like I said, we adopted this notion of run what you brung. So how can we make it so that no matter what the technology is that you brought with you, that we could make that work some way? And so that, I think there are a lot of challenges in there. But the other part of it is in terms of doing the pilots, we don't necessarily have to think in terms of institutionalizing. You know, institutions tend to turn like cruise ships, right? They make these really wide lumbering turns. And I think many times what we need to do with our experimentation is be a lot more agile and find out where that ship's turning to and be there first. And so that's where I think institutionalizing, it has its benefits and its drawbacks.
And Lisa, a question for you. How did you assess your mobile program successes? I think you mentioned a little bit about that during your presentation, but did you want to add anything?
Absolutely. Some of the things that we've done and we're continuing to do and will continue as we expand the project is that we did do pre-semester, mid-semester, and post-semester surveys, collecting data from the students. We're also looking at the iPads to see what other apps the students installed when they turned them in so that we'll have that data as well before we wipe them for the next batch of students. We also, again, have the accountability piece in regard to the apps where we have individuals review the apps that they're using for instructional purposes and gathering anecdotal data as well.
And then one last question for any or all of you. Do you have any tips or strategies, this is sort of the age-old question, to help faculty kind of adopt these mobile technologies? Do you have any incentives? How did you address that locally?
Shiny, happy faces. Really, it's about establishing the relationships and encouraging faculty to try something new, being available when they have questions. That's been our biggest selling point. You know, hey, look what we've got. We've got these new devices. Look what you can do with them. Being excited, demonstrating how we're using them, showing them what the potential of that device is, has been a huge selling point. And making them available. If you want to try it out, here it is. If you want an extended loan, we can work on that for you if we don't have a demand. So working with the faculty where they're comfortable.
Lisa, how about you? How did you get faculty to join in your pilot?
I agree with Jennifer in that, you know, we try to provide a safe, scaffolded place for faculty and staff to explore the use of the devices, and we're continuing to do that with new technologies. And so the idea of providing training, providing support, I go into the classrooms with the faculty if they want to try it, so that they have someone there who can help if needed. And, you know, that scaffolding, support, and training, I think, is really key. And that there's no risk to it as well.
Well, great. Thank you to all of our participants for those great questions. We didn't get to answer them all, but they were wonderful.
Kyle Bowen, Judy Brown, Jennifer Sparrow, Lisa Young, and Veronica Diaz. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.